Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast for the March issue of the Aldi, and I'm delighted to have an article by Annabelle Sampson, our digital editor, about going back to Jura, where she spent her childhood holidays. And we're very privileged to have Richard Blair, George Orwell's son, who grew up on Jura when Orwell was writing 1984, 70 years ago. So Richard, if I could begin with you, first tell me, which years were you there?
The first time I went up to Jura would have been in 1946. After my father had rented Barnhill, I think he probably popped up there to begin with. Then I came up later on during the summer with my nanny, Susan Watson. She brought me up. Well, my father had gone back down to London to bring us all up, and we went to, so like, I can't remember exactly, it would have been about August 1946.
Right.
And installed by that time was, of course, my father's younger sister, Avril. And the problem was, when the two of them got together, Avril and Susan Watson simply did not get on at all. I think the main problem was, first of all, Susan insisted on calling my father George, and Avril said, no, his name is not George, it's Eric. And I think that's where the antagonism started, and from there on it went downhill. They just didn't get on together. The problem was twofold. One was that Susan was handicapped. She had a bad hip, therefore her mobility was very poor. Secondly, she had a boyfriend whom my father couldn't stand, I don't think. And eventually the two of them just up sticks and left. I can't remember exactly when it was. It would have been a few months later, in 1946. So there I am with my father, his younger sister, Avril, living on...
And you're how old at this stage?
Well, at 1946, I would have been two and a half, or thereabouts. So that's... My father went back to Canonbury Square, and I can't remember if I went with him or whether I stayed on Jura with Avril. And going through the records, going through a lot of the books, and the diaries, I can't quite find out whether I was or was not there.
Right.
I suspect I probably was back down in Canonbury Square, I think. I would have to go and recheck that again and see if I'm talking rubbish or not.
But you were there in the year 1948 when
he was
writing.
Well, essentially I was there from August 1946 until we left... in the autumn of 1950, 8 months after my father had died.
Really, you were there that long? I didn't realise. And so, and you have memories of him actually typing, is that right?
Well, I would say yes, in the sense that you would hear, you would come down, you would have breakfast and he would play with me for a little bit, and then he would go upstairs to work during the morning, and then he would type. And you would hear him... Not every day, but presumably most days, you would hear him typing away on his typewriter. I think he did a lot of handwriting as well with 1984, but mostly typewritten. He would then come down for lunch, and because he liked to, very straightforward, he would have, you know, breakfast, then lunch, which was his main meal, and supper at night time. So after lunch, he would then go back up to his room and work away. By supper time, he would then come down, and if it was summertime, we would go out in the boat. If it was a nice night, we'd go fishing, we'd go looking at the lobster pots to see if we got any lobsters or crabs. And generally, he kind of socialised and tried to socialise with me, being very aware of the fact that he wasn't very well, and he just simply... He had this... I think he realised he had TB, and he was worried about the contact between himself and myself, whether I would pick up TB or not. It was highly unlikely. I was a fairly robust child. I showed no signs of any problems. But nevertheless, he did have me tested, I think, or was going to have me tested. He got a tuberculosis-free cow, milking cow. During the time that we were there in 1947, because he went back to Canterbury Square in 1947 for a little while during the winter. When he came back, we had a gentleman by the name of Bill Dunn who came and joined us at Barn Hill. He'd lost his leg during the war and was trying to do agriculture at Glasgow University, couldn't stand it, and decided to go into the practical side. Got a job with the Fletchers, or rather applied to the Fletchers, who said, well, you know, come over and stay on the farm above Barn Hill. It was at that time that my father had kind of came across him and invited Bill Dunn to join us at Barn Hill to run the farm, because my father was incapable of doing it. He couldn't do that. So that's when Bill Dunn then moved in with us at Barn Hill and became a sort of an unofficial partner. I think Richard Rees kind of, I don't think they drew up any paperwork, but Richard Rees was involved, because Richard Rees and my father were very good friends. And Richard Rees was kind of not quite overseeing, but sort of in the background, looking after my father at Barn Hill.
And your father had moved to Jura, which, for listeners who don't know, is a very beautiful island in the Inner Hebrides, but it's a remote island, and Barn Hill is a remote spot on that remote island. Why had he moved there?
The simple reason was that his great friend David Astor, who owned the Observer, had an estate on the island of Jura. And in 1945, after my mother had died, David had said to my father, well, you know, you could do the break. Perhaps you would like to go and spend, you know, a couple of weeks on the island where we have our estate, which happens to be the island of Jura. It could have been the island of Col, it could have been the island of Mull, it could have been anywhere. Right. It happened to be the island of Jura, where the Astors had their estate. So he went there and liked it so much, he went up to the North End and stayed with the people who had this farm above us, above Barn Hill, that I've just indicated. And he came back to London and said, I think I would quite like to take on Jura as a place to rent somewhere and be able to write, because then I can get away from London. I can get away from all this grey city and these people who keep on pestering me. Because Animal Farm had been published by then, so it was successful. So he had some money to spend to take him away from the hard work of London. So that's why he took this farmhouse called Barn Hill on Jura.
And it's a remarkably beautiful place, but if you could describe, was it rather austere place then in the late 40s?
Well, yes, it was a surprisingly large house. It had a farmhouse with outbuildings in the form of three sides of a square. The house itself was substantially built. Downstairs it had a big kitchen, or relatively big kitchen, a dining room and a sitting room. And adjacent to that was the steadings, which was all part and parcel. You could get from the house into what was called the milk house, which was then part of the byre or cowshed. Upstairs, four bedrooms, bathroom, which is with flush toilet and bath and wash hand basin. The kitchen had a range, a solid fuel range. So it was essentially quite well found, and it was waterproof. It was a bit drafty, I suppose, because these places were drafty, single pane glass windows, sort of drafty bits all over it. Doors didn't fit quite so well, and it was austere but comfortable in its own way.
And but if I could, if I could bring in Annabelle at this moment, Annabelle Sampson, the digital editor, has written about Jura, where she grew up on her holidays. You take the story on another 50 years, because you started going in the 90s as a little girl, as a toddler almost, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So my grandfather, Tony Riley Smith, who's my mum's dad, his father, William Riley Smith, bought it in something in the 1960s, I believe.
Right.
That may not be completely correct. And the family would go there frequently from that point onwards. My mum would go, as I mentioned in the piece, would go in every school holiday. So Christmas, then in the summer, they'd bring friends along. My mum, when she was newly married and was pregnant with my sister, lived there for 3 years, which was a point of contention in the family. Very moody older brother, who I also mentioned the piece, called Francis, who's now very sadly dead. But yeah, so lots and lots of family memories, and I would go on holidays in the summer.
And growing up there, how much were you aware of the Orwell connection as you grew up on Jura?
In all honesty, it was completely oblivious to it. And so it was very strange for me returning. So we sold the estate. So my family sold the estate in 2009. And Mum and I returned for the first time in October. Last year, and it was interesting. So we went to Barnhill, which we'd only ever venture in that direction if we were heading to Croyvreckan. So we go on family walks to go and observe the whirlpool, and I mentioned the piece, that we have barley broth and cheese scones, which were made by our chef Flora. And interestingly, going back, we were staying at the Jura Hotel, which was somewhere which my grandfather, Tony, used to run. He used to own it, as well as the distillery. And it was interesting staying in the Jura Hotel, but it was also, there was so much about George Orwell there, and going around the distillery, there's the big wooden placard around the main room, which sort of talks about George Orwell. There was a big portrait in the hotel, sort of living room, as well as an enormous facsimile.
You mentioned having picnics by the Croyvreckan Whirlpool, which to Orwell fans is very, very significant, because you, Richard, and your father very nearly died. Is that right, would you say?
Well, I suppose you could say nearly died. It didn't seem like that at the time. In 1947, summer 47, we had decided to go over from Barnhill over to the west coast to a place called Glengarrisdale, which had an old small house, for a bit of R&R. There was my father, myself, his nephew Henry Dakin, and his younger sister Lucy. There would have been Avril, and possibly Jane Dakin, as she would have been then. That was the older of the three children of Marjorie Blair, who was the older sister of my father. They would have been staying, it would come from time to time. So there'd been a whole group of us staying in Glengarrisdale. My father, myself, Henry, and Lucy decided to take the dinghy back round to Barnhill. The others walked over the hill. I think we were making hay at the time, and it was just simply a question of we'd cut the hay, we're just waiting for it to dry and before we could carry on. So come, I can't remember, it would have been a Sunday afternoon, I guess. I can't remember the exact date or day. My father miscalculated the tides going through Croyvreckan, arrived when the tide was still on the flood. In other words, it was running from east to west, which sounds a bit odd, but that's the way it works in that part of the world. And south to north, that's the, right. the flood tide. We got stirred up in the tideway, lost the outboard off the back of the dinghy, and Henry had to take to the oars and row for his life to the nearest point, which happened to be at the little island. There are two little islands, one slightly bigger than the other, in the Gulf, to one side of where the so-called whirlpool. Actually, it's not a whirlpool, it's called the Great Overfall, but it's not right. Split hairs. And we managed to get to this island. The geology of the West Coast is that it tends to rise from east up to the west and then fall directly back into the sea on the west side. So here we have a rocky landing of sort of 45 degrees coming out of the sea, covered in seaweed. Henry jumped ashore with the mooring line, pulled the dinghy as far up as he could with the swell. The swell receded, the dinghy slid back in, turned upside down, and I was sitting in the back with my father sitting on his knee, and we were tipped into the sea underneath the dinghy, from which we came of spluttering.
You were terrified, were you?
No, I don't think so. Well, not at that point. Probably I didn't enjoy being ducked in the water very much. Up to that point, I think it was quite enjoyable. Nobody showed any sign of stress or distress. I suppose really to upset me, perhaps. And so we came out spluttering and managed to scramble ashore. Now, the point is, and I make this point when we go there with the Orwell Society every other year, that we could so easily, or my father could so easily have hit his head on a rock. The tide would have been running past us, you know, one or two knots, and he could quite easily have been taken away. And if once he had lost contact with the shore, any side of rock or anything, you know, seaweed or anything like that, he would have been carried away and would very quickly have drowned. And indeed, I suppose I would have as well.
Absolutely horrifying.
So it happened. We scrambled ashore and everyone said, oh, well, that was a bit close, wasn't it? A bit silly. And made very light of it. So, you know, but in the twinkling of an eye, these things can change. And change for the worse. That's how accidents happen.
Yeah. No, well, you were very lucky. And Annabelle, if we can flip back to the modern day, when you went back last year, an extraordinary development has happened at Jura on your old land, on the family's old estate. What's happened there?
So I mentioned that we sold the estate in 2009. And this ludicrously wealthy hedge fund manager called Greg Coffey, who is known as the Wizard of Oz due to his trading prowess, yeah, and being Australian. He has bought Jura House and the Ardfin estate, which Jura House sits in. And he has created this premier golf course, which I describe the piece as being sort of quite like Lord of the Rings, with sort of crashing waves, searing cliffs, and then smart green mown squares.
And it's a private golf course, just for him, is that right?
So it's to be decided how it's going to be, how it's going to be run in the future, but it's currently private. And actually, we went for a recce round, which was quite a surprise, to say the least. And he's, apparently, one of the Astors had been round the day before to practice.
And how did you feel about the beloved spot of your childhood holidays becoming a golf course?
It's been a fairly substantial period of time. So it was, I felt sad, but I also was very curious and intrigued to see how it had developed. So the house, which was originally grey, was 2.5 times the size and clad in Portuguese limestone, sort of sandy colour, and you could sort of see various sort of swimming pool developments going on, which was quite a shock. But also it shows great vision. We would never have thought about creating a golf course, so it's pretty interesting. And also it was run down and needed a large amount of money to regenerate it.
And Richard, you go back to Jura quite often. Have you seen these developments?
I've been past this golf course on 3 or 4 occasions in my own boat when we come down through the Sound of Islay. Since Greg Coffey bought the estate in 2009. So we've been watching this development with incredulous interest, I think is the way one would describe it. It's a bit ambivalent on the island. I can think of people up the North End who think he's a complete... Mm. There are those who are involved who don't say very much because he is leaving some money with them. But he imported humongous amounts of 2 or 3 dozen or more Irishmen to create this golf course.
Incredible.
He didn't... how many local people got involved with the actual physical creation, I don't know, so I can't comment. For whose benefit is the golf course? Now, originally it was going to be for his rich friends. Now, why would you create a world-class golf course on Jura? Frankly, if I was a high-profile, important person, I would go there once and I'd think, bugger this, I'm not doing it again. So I think he's mellowed slightly in that I think he's kind of opening it up to other people, and in other words, a more commercial venture. Whether it succeeds, I pass no comment. If he wants to get rid of a lot of money, that was a very good way of doing it.
Yes.
It's soaked up millions. I mean, he's been bringing in solid, oh God, the amount of effort he's put into it is extraordinary. Now, if you can get people like Donald Trump to come over and play golf, whoopee, so much the better. So I don't know. I guess the guy knows what he's doing.
I mean, in itself, it's a great technical accomplishment. Jura is probably the boggiest place. And the fact that the day that I went round, it was very true to that. It didn't stop raining. It was incredibly wet. And the golf course looked pristine. It was immaculate.
Good drainage, yes. Yep.
Well,
yeah.
Obviously, you spend a fortune on drainage, of course, you'd have to. Because it's just... The thing about that end of Jura is it's about the only fertile part of the island that is truly fertile in the sense that it's capable of growing crops. It has good grass, you could grow, with care, you grow crops of oats. You grow grass for silage and feed your cattle that way. In the days of old, of course, when I was there, and up till, crikey, I suppose, the 60s, all the farming on Jura was of a traditional sense, in that you cut your grass for hay, you cut it and you let it wilt and then you let it dry. Well, hell's bells. It's a struggle to dry. Right. So you struggled to make hay in the traditional sense. Then, of course, silage came in and that kind of improved things. Jura Estate, well, I mean, I don't think there's any farming done there at all now, as far as I know.
I don't believe so, because so when we looked round, they're all the different parts of the estate have sort of been transformed. So the old farmstead is now a private hotel for the golf course guests.
Yes. So I don't know. I'm going back again in June, and I will dig around and find out what the latest score is so far, as far as that's concerned. The other thing he was doing, as I understand it, he was buying up a lot of empty housing, or any house that came up for sale in Craig House, he was buying. I guess for the purposes of putting his guests in who would want to come over and play golf. But I don't know if it's as black and white as that, so I can't fully comment.
And
I would hate to be quoted or misquoted of saying something that wasn't true.
Of course. So this year we're celebrating the 70th anniversary of Orwell writing 1984. In 1948, he flipped the two numbers at the end of the year. Is that right?
Well, that's yes. Okay. Well, that's as
not true. No, do you say
no,
you're
no,
there?
No, no. It's about as true as you're going to get, I think.
You don't believe that?
No. It was probably as good a story as any.
Right. As Annabelle refers to in her piece, it's always been incredibly popular, obviously, in 1984, an absolutely marvellous book. But there was a huge boom in sales a year ago, is that right, Richard?
Yes, in 2017, certainly the first part of, the first 6 months of 2017, after the inauguration of Donald Trump, the sales in the United States absolutely took off by a factor of 10.
Amazing.
Extraordinary. Up till then, there would have been about 100,000 units of Animal Farm 1984, e-books of one sort or another, which was a relatively steady sale in the States, plus or minus. Last year, it factored by 10.
And went up to a million.
And went up to a million.
Incredible, yeah.
It's probably settled back down again now. I don't know, I haven't spoken to Bill. I might see him this afternoon, actually. So I don't know what's going on at the moment, but it was certainly last year Donald Trump elevated or what was her name, Kellyanne Conway.
Oh, yes.
Elevated the conversation to the point where everyone, what's going on here? We better go and buy 1984 and just double check here.
How extraordinary. Well, I think we'll wind up by, it obviously sounds extraordinary, Jura, and to our listeners who haven't been there, it's striking that your father, George Orwell, went there, the Astors went there, our former Prime Minister, David Cameron, went there, and now this new hedge funder man is going there. If, in turn, you could say why you think it's so extraordinary, Jura. First, Annabelle, can you tell me?
I think the landscape is just incredibly dramatic. And I mentioned in the piece that despite the rain, and this summer was very, very wet, you can just, it's all the beauty in the Paps. So there's the three Paps of Jura sort of emerging through the mist. And also all the deer. My mum remembered seeing a stag emerging from the sea, and she could just see this, I think it's a royal, when it has a full head of antlers, emerging from the water. And it's kind of this sort of, quite mystical, I suppose. And it's just truly untainted natural beauty.
And Richard, for you, it must be full of incredibly powerful memories. Perhaps your most powerful memories of your father are there?
Oh, I think so. To me, it's my spiritual home. Well, certainly the west coast of Scotland is my spiritual home. my ashes are going to go out through Corryvreckan. So Corryvreckan will finally get its due.
Well, they will literally be poured on Corryvreckan.
I won't be conscious.
No, exactly. What a beautiful gesture. That's wonderful.
but that's what's going to happen. For me, Jura is the most remarkable island. As you were saying, Annabelle, it's this rugged beauty. Not many people live there. You've got 5,000 plus head of red deer, of which Jura, which of course Jura is the Norse for deer.
Didn't know that, right.
And so it's had red deer for millennia. It's been well known for it. They're looked after, today they're looked after in the sense that they are culled properly and so on and so forth. It's such a rugged place. It's uninhabited on the west coast. Nobody lives there. You can walk it for miles and miles and miles and not see anybody for days if you wanted to, if you were so inclined to hike on your own. It's just remarkable that the raised beaches, the caves, there's a lot of feral goats there, by the way, as well. And it just has this single track road running from from up the east coast, petering out at Ardlasa into a 7 mile track that takes you up to Barn Hill, desperately remote. I mean, the poignant moment I remember sitting in the back of the car in January 1949, with my father when he was leaving for the last time. And you just, if you see a photograph, you just see this road disappearing into over the moors, as it were. And it's a very, very evocative, very emotional picture for me, because this was the last thing my father ever saw, as he and I sat in the back of the car, because it had broken down again. And that was him leaving the island for the last time to go to Cranham Sanatorium in Gloucestershire. So, to me, Jura has a huge amount of emotional impact on me, and always will have. And that's why in the last 20-odd years, I've gone back probably once or at least twice a year in our own boat to go back round to the west coast, to the uninhabited part. So wonderful, but I don't know if you, what they call West Loch Tarbert, which is a great indentation that almost cuts Jura in half. Wonderful anchorages, remote, you can't get there, you can't get any radio, you can't get any VHF reception, you can get nothing there. It's absolutely, it's a black hole, but wonderfully remote. And also Craig House, which of course is the little village, and we go in and you go to Jura Hotel and have a meal and so on and so forth. So that's what I just loved going there. And I sadly, I've sold my boat, so I won't have the opportunity to go so often now. But as the Oar Society, or the patron Oar Society, we'll go every second year and take our members to Craig House, and then we go up to Barn Hill. And I take them around Barn Hill and show them, you know, where he did his typing and where I split my head in the bathroom and
blinds. I couldn't believe how enormous Barn Hill was.
It's a big house.
Yeah, it's really big.
Yes, indeed. And so, you know, very cold.
Yes, I can imagine.
No central heating, even today.
Oh, really?
Very, it has electric light, which is run from a generator. So it's, it hasn't changed a lot since 1945, 46.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. I'm so grateful to Richard Blair, George Orwell's son, and to Annabel Sampson for taking part in the Oldie podcast.
Thank you.